We listen to Ronnie. Ronnie remembers, remembers the oldies, the 50s and 60s.
You're listening to Marie Elena, the title track from one of approximately 20 guitar albums released by today's guest, who is, in fact, a world-renowned guitar virtuoso. But that's only part of his story. He's also a universally respected songwriter and producer, and he's played guitar on and written arrangements for dozens and dozens of hit records. A show of this length can't really do full justice to everything he's accomplished. So please consider what you're about to hear to be a representative sample of some of the highlights of his incredible career. This amazing man has spent more time on this planet and has more experience in the music business than anyone I have ever interviewed. Now, does that seem just about right, Billy Muir?
You figure the math out. I'm 95 years old now, and I started in the music business when I was 17.
Wow. It's absolutely incredible. In fact, I understand that at the age of 21, during the height of the Depression, you joined the Isham Jones Jazz Band.
Right. That was the first band I ever joined. My father wanted me to go to college, and I went for 2 weeks, City College, and I said, no, that's not for me. I came home brokenhearted, and he said, well, what do you want to do? I said, I want to follow a musical career. So he said, okay, that's what you want to do. So next day, with a guitar under my arm, I went down to Broadway, and I ran into a guy from high school, and he said, Isham Jones is looking for a guitar player. And I ran over to the hotel, did the audition, and that started my career, and I was 17 years old.
We're going to talk a little bit about Arthur Godfrey. Now, he had a radio and a TV show, and I believe at some point they were simulcasting, weren't they? Whether it was the radio and TV show on at the same time, I believe?
I don't know too much about his earlier career, because I didn't join him until the last 7 years of radio. He wasn't on TV anymore.
Were you with the Archie Blyer Orchestra?
Right.
Okay.
And I did arrangements for Archie Blyer when he got too busy.
You did ghost arranging?
That's right.
What does ghost arranging mean?
Ghost arranging is Archie would be very busy doing a lot of other things, arranging and what have you, and he didn't have time enough to do some of the arranging. So he'd come to me and say, I'll give you a couple of tunes to do. Of course, I'd get paid for it, but my name would not appear on the arrangement in any way. They still would be Archie Blyer arrangement. And that's what I did for Don Costa.
The name that would appear on the ghost arrangement would still be a Bill, but it would be Bill something else, right?
Well, when I started doing a lot of other sessions, I used a lot of names because I could not use Billy Muir. I was under contract to RCA Victor.
Oh, I see.
So I used Billy Rock, Billy Small, Billy Murphy, just Billy Sebastian.
Oh, gee whiz.
whatever name came to mind.
Were you with the Arthur Godfrey show when Julius LaRosa was on the show?
No, I was not. But if you want to hear the true story, as they told it to me, would you like to hear it?
We're talking about the firing of Julius LaRosa.
Yes. Julius was hired while he sang a song in the Navy. Arthur liked him, and he hired him. One day, the manager came to Arthur and said, we want out of the contract. He is getting so big, and he'll be giant. They were heading to be bigger than Sinatra. And Arthur said, wow, I still have him for 7 years. He said, we know that, but we'd like to cancel that out. So they went on the air, and Arthur said, gee, I hired him when he sang. I'm thinking I'll fire him when he finished this song, which he did. He said, that was your swan song.
Yes.
And it was the worst thing that Arthur ever did, because from then on, his career went downhill. And worse than that, his children got a lot of heck at school doing such a thing. But nobody really knew the true story.
Are you telling me that actually Julius and his manager wanted out of the contract?
Exactly. They thought he would get much further being on his own. It was a mistake, because poor guy never made it.
You mean subsequent to that?
Subsequently he never made it.
He had one hit record that was huge around the time of the firing, which was Hey Compare.
Was it with Archie Blyer?
Yes.
I think I was on that record. Hey Compare, sure.
Hey Compare, ci può suonare, chi si suona un violino, è come si suona un violino, a zinga zingu violina, blinga blingu mandolin, tu 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 u saxofona, u friskalette tippiti tippiti ta.
A bling, a ping, a saxophone, a toot, a toot, a fat, whatever. Are you basically telling me that the night that Arthur Godfrey fired Julius LaRosa, Julius did not know that he was going to be fired that night?
No.
So that's what the thing was.
It was on the spur of the moment that Arthur thought, well, I hired him when he sang a song, now I'll fire him the same way.
Right.
We'll turn Manhattan into an island. Thanks ever so much, Julie. That was Julie's swan song with us. He goes now out on his own as his own star, soon to be seen in his own programs. And I know you wish him Godspeed, same as I do. This is the CBS Radio Network.
If that firing had not occurred, the chances are that Julie was not going to be with the show much longer anyway. That's what you're basically telling me.
Possibly not.
Now, Billy, getting back to your own career, when did you get your first guitar?
Well, I started on violin. There was a relative that was a violin teacher, and he taught me violin, which was a very big help, because in those days, a lot of the guitar players, like Tony Gattuso, was an excellent player, but didn't know C from D. But when I came in, there was a guitar in my father's beauty parlor, and when I swept the floor and got 25 cents, then I go in the back and practice the guitar, and I taught myself, actually.
You answered my next question. I was going to say, are you self-taught?
Yep.
You mean you never took a guitar lesson in your life?
No, never. Of course, my father showed me a little bit about the guitar.
Oh, okay. That doesn't count, though.
No.
You didn't take any paid lessons, so to speak.
No, never.
He did it just gratis. Okay.
But I think the fact that I knew music because of having studied violin was a tremendous help.
Oh, wow. I'm going to play a little sample of your guitar work. This is something called Tiger Guitars. When did you do Tiger Guitars?
Oh, don't ask me about dates. I haven't the vaguest idea.
Bluff. You can bluff. It must have been in the 50s.
I would think so.
Okay.
Well, I was at WNEW from 47 to 57,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
And about 57 is when I started doing supersonic guitars and started doing a lot of sessions for myself.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Billy Muir and Tiger Guitars. Guitars, getting us to a rip-roaring start. Billy, you have, among other things, certain chart records where people know the name Billy Muir. I'm going to mention those first, and then we're going to backtrack to recording sessions that you were on. Let's start with something called Got a Match.
Oh, yeah. That was the very first endeavor. It was with a friend of mine, Dick Wolf. We wrote this together, and we recorded, and I foot the bill for the session for a very small company.
Cabot Records, I believe?
Yes, Cabot Records.
Do you remember who was on the session?
Other than Dick Wolf and I really don't recall.
Right.
Dick played the piano, and I played the guitar. We had a bass and drums, and
We
had somebody, At first, I tried to do it. Hey there, got a match? And we didn't like the way it sounded. Then Dick tried it. Hey there, got a match? He didn't like it. So we hired somebody, but I don't recall who it was.
The group was called?
Daddy-O's.
Yeah, it got to the national top 40 on the chart, and we're going to listen to it right now. These are the Daddy-O's, Billy Muir on guitar, and Got a Match? Songwriter, it's great to have a chart record of one of your records, but that wasn't the only chart record. The Got a Match was also done by Frank Gallup, and I understand that you actually helped the competition. Did you arrange the Frank Gallup record as well?
Well, I was a very good friend of Don Costa. As a matter of fact, I got him his first job when he came to town, and he remembered that, and he used me many times to try to pay me off, I guess. And Frank Gallup was a friend of his, and he said, I'd like for you to arrange the session because I'm very busy. And so I arranged the session for Frank Gallup, and it was similar to my record, but it was a little bit different. Frank Gallup had a fabulous voice. Hey there, got a match?
Yes, and before I play a little bit of Frank Gallup's record, I want to remind people that Frank was the announcer on the Perry Como show.
That's right.
He always had that same style, and this was actually competing
right
with the Daddy-O's on the chart.
Right.
This is Frank Gallup, and Got a Match.
Hey there, got a match? Hey there, never mind.
So you actually, if we include the fact that you wrote the arrangement for the Daddy-O's, you actually wrote the arrangement for the Frank Gallup record too. So you arranged both recordings that were actually competing with each other.
I ghost wrote for Don Costa. I'll tell you later on about the other arranging that I did for him. He was very busy.
It's called ghost arranging.
Right.
People know what ghost writing is. And ghost arranging is something similar where you don't use your real name, but you do the job.
Okay. That's right.
Let's talk about something called String of Trumpets. But before we talk about String of Trumpets, you wrote a song, and I believe it was recorded by Danny Davis.
Danny Davis turned out to be one of my dearest friends, and he recorded Trumpet Cha-Cha-Cha.
Now, this is a song that you wrote by yourself.
Right, which I also arranged.
Let's play a little bit of the Danny Davis record, Trumpet Cha-Cha-Cha.
Big hit in New York. think it sold 75,000 copies in New York alone.
Yes.
And on the strength of that, Danny Davis got a job with RCA as A&R man.
Now, is this the same Danny Davis that eventually went to Nashville?
That's right.
Danny Davis and the Nashville...
Brass.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay.
His wife hated going to Nashville.
Really?
Because she loved New York. But about 6 months later, I ran into her and she's, "Yo, come down here, see us?"
Well, I guess the money must have helped.
Yeah.
When the money comes rolling in,
Chet Atkins, who was in charge of RCA at the time, auditioned him and spoke to him and convinced him to come to Nashville, and he gave him an A&R job.
String of Trumpets. Now, I remember... String of Trumpets, and I also remember that there were different pressings of it. Some of the pressings just billed the group as the Trumpeteers. Some of the other pressings billed the group as Billy Muir and the Trumpeteers. Now, you don't play trumpet, do you?
Now, this would happen. Danny Davis recorded Trumpet Cha-Cha-Cha, and on the strength of that, Everest said to me, "We want to do a trumpet album with you." I said, "I don't play trumpet." He said, "That doesn't matter. Get yourself some trumpet players, and we'll do an album called The String of Trumpets." I got seven great trumpet players, the best I've ever heard, and we did the whole album, String of Trumpets.
Wow.
And that's how that came about.
And some of the trumpet players, Doc Severinsen, I believe, was on that record, right?
Yeah, Doc Severinsen.
Charlie Shavers.
Right.
Now Charlie was with the... Tommy Dorsey band,
right.
Yeah.
He was terrific.
Seven trumpets were in the string.
Seven. I can't remember the names of some of them, but they were really considered the best trumpet players around.
We're going to listen to String of Trumpets right now in its entirety. Were you on the record at all, or was it all trumpets?
I played guitar rhythm. I led the band.
But, ladies and gentlemen, Billy Muir did not blow a single note. He left that to the trumpeteers. Title, String of Trumpets.
Yeah.
Did you have any other possibilities before you came to that, or did you just say...
No, that just came to me as I was calling the musician, the trumpet player. I said, "Wow, that's really a string of trumpets. Fabulous."
Fantastic. I'm Ronnie Allen talking with Billy Muir. And Billy, I've known and respected your work for years, and I never dreamed that many, many years later I would be doing this interview with you and talking about your wonderful career. And I thank you so much for agreeing to do it.
It's a great pleasure.
Billy, among your many accomplishments, you wrote the legendary theme song for Murray the K and his swinging soiree on 1010 Winds in New York City. Could I prevail upon you to do just a little bit of that right now?
Here it is. It's Murray
kick in the head.
Wow. Now, initially it was Murray Kaufman, the suit before he was Murray the K.
Yeah, right.
And then they changed it to Murray the K and the Swingin' Soiree. You wrote that theme.
Right.
Everybody, certainly in the New York area, remembers that theme.
Oh, yes.
We have to talk about the Delicates.
Right.
Who were Murray the K's dancing girls and also wrote and recorded many of his theme songs.
Right.
I have a very close connection with the Delicates because this interview is being done for a website called Jersey Girl Thing. And one of the two Jersey girls is Denise Ferry. The other is Bernadette Carroll. Well, Denise was a member. In fact, she still is because the Delicates are still around and still do occasional singing. And the Delicates consisted of Denise Ferry and Arlene Lanzotti and Peggy Santillia. And they recorded two great sides when they were with Unart Records, and you got the job of producing the Delicates. So first of all, let me ask you, Billy, how did you get the job of producing these three girls?
Well, from time to time, record companies called me and offered me arranging jobs. And they had this group that they liked. They said, you do the arrangements. I said, okay. So I got together with the girls, listened to the tunes, and I suggested Ronnie Is My Lover, and that's what we did.
Ronnie Is My Lover is one that you co-wrote with your partner, Dick Wolfe.
Correct.
Who is doing ba-da-ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum at the beginning of the record, Ronnie Is My Lover?
Ba-dum, 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 ba-dum. Ba-dum, 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 ba-dum.
I guess you just answered the question, I guess. It was you.
It was me, yeah.
Ba-dum, 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 ba-dum.
Ronnie is my lover, ooh-wee. Ronnie is my lover, Ronnie is my lover till eternity. Till eternity.
Um, ba-dum, ba-dum.
Ronnie is my lover. How did I discover such a sweetheart with a heart so ready?
Ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum.
All the girls are jealous.
One of the two sides of that classic Delicates record. Now, you and Dick wrote that song, and you also did the arrangement, I take it, right?
Yes, I did.
And you produced the record?
Right.
And after the session, you swept the floor? Cleaned out the studio and did everything?
The only floor sweeping I did was for my father's beauty parlor.
Oh, okay. Well, there's one other thing you didn't do on the record. You didn't do the female voices on that record.
No, I didn't.
You left that to the girls.
Right, and girls were terrific.
They were.
It.
Oh, gosh. And, of course, I like that song because what's my name? Ronnie. The interesting thing is that the other side of that record also got a lot of attention, and it was a song that was written by the three girls.
Right.
What could you tell us about Black and White Thunderbird?
Well, I thought it was very cute, and recently I heard it, and I said, what a great idea for the automobile company. So one of these days I'm going to see who's in charge of the advertising for the automobile company and present the song.
Beep, 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 Thunderbird. Beep, 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 yeah. Beep, beep, say so much, I'm so far. Say a little more than a bummy car. With the back of a Thunderbird, so new, black of a Thunderbird. So cool, black of a Thunderbird, happy as I can be. Ah-ha, ah-ha. Thunderbird,
look into it and see if we can get it going in black and white, Thunderbird.
We'll see. We're going to spend the next few moments talking about recording sessions that you have done. You sent me a CD that has 24 of them. We're not going to get
Oh, yeah.
All
you're talking about some of my friends.
Oh, your friends. Boy,
yeah.
There are so many of them. Marty Robbins, you're all familiar with a white sport coat and a pink carnation, and the sound at the beginning of that record, and that sound came about because of you, Billy Muir, right?
Right. Well, we had done one take, and Mitch Miller must have liked me because he used me on every artist that he had on Columbia. And he came to me and he said, this arrangement sounds kind of empty. He said, what do you think you can do? So I came up with this guitar lick, which turned out to be the hook that made the hit record.
And you're talking about bum, 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 bum,
bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, right.
Wow.
That was my hook.
A white sport coat and a pink carnation. I'm all dressed up for the dance. A white sport coat and a pink.
Marty Robbins, a great talent. Did you know Marty personally?
No, never met him, never talked to him or anything. I never knew about the little talk that I had with Mitch Miller either.
Was Marty actually at the session, or did you do the track first?
He was at the session.
But you just didn't really get to talk to him?
No.
So let's see, we got Paul Anka, Diana.
Right. Paul Anka was 13 years old, and Don Costa played his demo for me. I said, boy, the kid's terrific. 13 years old, and he wrote the song. Don Costa said, we're going to record him. I said, fine. I think there's four guitars on it. It was a great record. We went to Las Vegas to see his show, and he does a great show in Vegas. Anyway, at the end of the show, I knocked on the door. I said, who is it? I said, Billy Muir. He come out and hugged me, and he treated me so differently. I think because he felt that we were part of his whole life career. Because I was on his record. I said to him, I can't get any tickets for Frank Sinatra. In 2 minutes, he got me two seats for Frank Sinatra. So
oh,
that's
wow.
What I remember about
well, that
him.
Was your, that was your reward. Now, which guitar did you play? You said there were four guitars on Diana.
All the one guitar that you hear the most of.
Is you.
Right.
Diana, featuring, among others, Billy Muir on the guitar. You did the Ames Brothers, Ragmop, R-A-G-G-M-O-P-P. Any interesting Ames Brothers story?
No, not really. I didn't think it was a smart song when I looked at it, went to arrange it. It didn't grab me for some reason or other. But the more I got into it, the more I liked it. And finally, the final record was just dynamite. The arrangements and the sound of the guitar, and they really were terrific guys to work with.
And you played electric guitar on that one, too?
Yeah, I played all the solos and all the background licks.
Fisher, were you working with Hugo Winterhalter then?
Yes, I did a lot of things for Hugo Winterhalter, terrific arranger. A lot of dates with him, with other artists.
So you're playing electric guitar on this one, Anytime, by
right.
Eddie Fisher.
So anytime you say you want me back again, that's the time I'll come back home.
My favorite records from the 50s was by Don Rondo, great vocalist. He had a great recording called White Silver Sands. What really grabs me about that recording is the guitar in that recording, and I think you told me yesterday that was actually you.
Right.
That was you. Did you actually come up with that arrangement, or were you just playing notes that had been arranged by somebody else?
No, I arranged it. Those are my recording notes.
Wow.
What happened, he came to my house, and he brought his piano player to rehearse the song. And he also brought a snare drum, because he used to be a drummer, and he played drums. And we rehearsed, I played guitar, and he played drums and the piano player, and we rehearsed the song. At the end of the evening, he said goodnight and forgot the snare drum there. So the next day, my son grabbed it. What is this? A snare drum. And he became a drummer.
Yeah.
Anyway, we did the recording.
We're going to listen to it right now. Don Rondo and White Silver Sands.
Where the deep blue pearly waters wash upon white silver sands, there on the brink of love I kissed her and obeyed our heart's command. We watched the sun set in the evening, see the moon yellow and pale, watch the gauchos ride the pillows out across the pampas trail. Where the deep blue pearly waters wash upon white silver sands, there on the brink of love I kissed her and obeyed our heart's command.
Don Rondo, White Silver Sands, and the electric guitar that you hear on that record is Mr. Billy Muir playing it. I'm Ronnie Allen talking to Billy. You arranged some of those, and you also arranged some other recordings, and one of them was Della Reese, and that reminds me. And that was on the same label, I believe, that Don Rondo was on Jubilee. And
right,
I mean, and
that's right, and Jerry Blaine was the owner, and he called me his hit maker, because we did two or three in a row, all hit records. Interesting story about Della Reese was that they had a song that they thought, oh, this is what a dynamite. I don't even remember the song, but they said, this is going to be a hit. It's great. So we spent 3 hours on the one song, and then we only had one other song to do, which was And That Reminds Me. So we did one take on That Reminds Me, and they said, that's it. Uh-huh. 2 weeks later, I get a call from Jerry Blaine, and he said, guess what? They turned the record around, and it is now a real big hit, a huge hit. And she went from $200 a week to $5,000 on a TV show.
And you arranged And That Reminds Me.
Right.
And were you playing on the record, too? On that
record? Oh, of course. And I think that's where I learned a little bit about hooks. The hook on this record was that I doubled the tempo.
Oh.
And boy, as soon as I did that, the record just jumps out.
If I could hear no music, if there could be no roses, no summer night to make me dream as I do, perhaps I might forget you, but in my heart I know that I need no reminder to miss you so. I hear the sound of music, your favorite kind of music, and that reminds me, dear, of you. I see the summer roses, your favorite shade of roses, and that reminds me, too, of you.
An interesting recording, which is called A Death Rock and Roll Song, was Ray Peterson, Tell Laura I Love Her, and you arranged that as well.
Yeah, well, about 9 p.m. the night before we were supposed to record Tell Laura I Love Her, Ray Peterson called me and said his girlfriend convinced him not to do the record. The song was too morbid, but you and Luigi convinced him to do it, and voila, a big hit.
He drove his car to the racing ground. He was the youngest driver there. The crowd roared as they started the race. Round the track they drove at a deadly pace. No one knows what happened that day, how his car overturned in flames. But as they pulled him from the twisted wreck, with his dying breath, they heard him say, tell Laura I love her, tell Laura I need her, tell Laura not to cry, my love for her will never die.
Marcy Blaine, you did the arrangement for Bobby's Girl.
I don't recall too much about her. I did this for some English owner.
The record label was Seville Records.
Seville, right. They gave me the song, and I arranged it, but I don't recall too much about her. Mm-hmm. I think the hook on that song was I decided to use a bass guitar, and the bass guitar just plays all through the record. Seems to me that was probably the hook.
Me, what would you like to be now that you're not a kid anymore?
You're not a kid anymore.
I know just what to say. I answer right away. There's just one thing I've been wishing for. Thing to me.
In those days, can you imagine I did two and three and even four rest sessions a week on groups that I had never heard of and never heard since. And it was just incredible how much business there was with rock and roll mostly.
Right. There's a funny story about one of the sessions you did involving Perry Como. It has to do with your watch going off in the middle of
Oh, my goodness. Right. I did many sessions with Perry Como, and I did his TV show along with Tony Mottola, who is my idol, by the way. And anyway, we're doing Don't Let the Stars Get in Your Eyes.
Right.
He does one take and walks out, put the jacket over his arms like he always did, and he was going to go play golf. So the producer yells over the microphone, "Perry, wait a minute, we've only got one take. If the tape breaks, we got $10,000 we blow." Says, "Please do another take." Said, "Okay." Goes back. And while he's doing this second take, my wrist alarm went off. I wished I was in a hole someplace else. Anyway, what happened, he comes over to me. He says, "What the heck was that, Billy?" I said, "Well, I bought this wrist alarm to remind me when to take my medications because I got bleeding ulcers." He was very sympathetic, and he said, "Don't worry about it. We'll do another take." He was very nice, by the way.
Don't let the stars get in your eyes. Don't let the moon break your heart. Love blooms at night. In daylight it dies. Don't let the stars get in your eyes. Oh, keep your heart from me, for someday I'll return, and you know you're the only one I'll ever love. Too many nights.
Too many nights.
Too many stars.
Too many stars.
Too many moons to change your mind.
Don't let the moon change your mind.
If I'm gone too long, don't forget where you belong. When the stars come out, remember you are mine.
They never saved the take where that alarm went off. I would have loved to have heard that.
I never thought of that. That would have been worth a couple of bucks.
I would think so.
It turned out to be a $2 million seller, the biggest hit he ever had.
Let's talk about one other record that you were on, and there's a very interesting story about this. Res Prado came to fame in 1955 with a song called Cherry Pink and Apple Blossom White. And then he had a period of time when he wasn't having hit records, but then came Patricia. And it was because of something that you did that helped the record Patricia become a hit.
We talk about the hook. This really had a hook and a hook and a half. Anyway, the producer was a friend of mine. He came to me and he said, "We've done a record of Res Prado. I want you to hear it." So I listened to it and I said, "There's no rhythm." He said, "That's exactly what the problem is." He said, "What do you want to do about it?" I said, "I'll get you a rhythm section, and I think that should make a big difference." So I got out the rock drummer, Panama Francis, then I got a couple of other rhythm players, and I played guitar, and we had a fabulous rhythm section. But the funny part of it is the rhythm section that we played was even eighths, which means if you're not a musician, it's music that goes la, 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 la. And what Pres Prado had was la, 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 la. So putting the two together was probably the worst thing I could have done. But because it was not authentic rock and roll, and it wasn't authentic Latin, and I think that was the hook that made the record, it was different. If you listen to the rhythm, it was a rock and roll rhythm. And you listen to Pres Prado, it was a Latin rhythm.
Right.
And the two of them just seemed to gel.
Billy, you've had an incredible career as a session musician, as a producer, as an arranger, as a songwriter. I'm going to play one of your guitar recordings. You did a song called Peanut Vendor.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of a classic from one of your late 50s albums. ¶¶ Billy, we have a wealth of riches here, and I would love to say hello to Debbie if she's around. So is she there right now?
Yeah. Before we do her, can I just mention one thing?
Sure.
That I've got a new recording coming out. And it's 24 songs that I've written, I arranged, I sing on, I own the publishing, and we're promoting the number one song on this album, and it's called The Many Voices of Billy Muir, and the name of the song is I Found Me a Girl. You don't have that, do you?
I happen to have it right here.
My goodness.
Boy, oh boy, I found me a girl, oh boy. She loves the way that I talk, loves the way that I walk. She loves everything that I do. Boy, oh boy, I found me a girl, some pearl. She loves just any old tune, any time that I croon. Ba-doodly, ba-doodly, boo. She gives me happiness every day of my life. I know that I won't rest till I make her my lawful wedded wife. Ooh, boy, oh boy, I found me a joy, oh boy. She's just a livin'est queen, and she's only 18. What's more, she can cook. Ooh, boy, oh boy, what a girl. I'm in love. Boy, oh boy, I found me a gal, some pal. She's got me dancing on air. We're a wonderful pair. It should happen to you. Ooh, boy, oh boy, I found me a lass, what class. She loves to walk in the park, loves to kiss in the dark. She loves the same thing that I do. She's got me hypnotized when I look in her eyes. I know that I can't wait till I make her my ever-loving mate. Ooh, boy, oh boy, I found me a girl, oh boy. I'm number one on her list, and she's never been kissed. What's more, she's got dough. Oh,
when did you do this album?
On and off for the last several years. What happened was that I was interested mostly in becoming a guitar player. I reached that goal. I did 20 albums. I did 2 movie themes. Every time I'd write a song, I put it in a file. So a couple of months ago, I opened up the file and I find 24 songs that I've written in 75 years. And I put them all in one album called The Many Voices of Billy Muir. And the reason I did that, because the second song is me singing like a 13-year-old boy who didn't like to practice piano.
Mom, what time is it?
That's me singing. So I thought, well, hey, what a great title, The Many Voices of Billy Muir.
Billy, right now we're going to say hello to your very close friend, who happens to be with you. Her name is Debbie. Hello, Debbie.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you, Debbie?
Great, thank you.
Debbie Brown Murphy?
Correct.
Yeah, that's the name you use. Do you use Debbie Murphy or Debbie Brown Murphy?
No, now I use Debbie Murphy, but when I was singing when I was younger, it was Debbie Brown. So we just put it together.
I have a couple of CDs. I have one that is called Debbie Brown Murphy, Brown in parentheses, and it's called Now and Then. You worked with several big bands?
Yes, I worked with Billy May. He had the slurping saxophone sound that was very popular for a while.
Right.
And I was with him for about a year, and then I was with Hal McIntyre. He had a big hit song called Sentimental Journey. Then I went with Pee Wee Hunt, the Dixieland band,
and he
had the 12th Street Rag.
Were you with him when he had the 12th Street Rag?
No, I wasn't. This was a time afterwards when we had done a tour, because he usually didn't carry a girl singer, and they were doing a big, long tour of the Army bases during the Cold War.
Right.
And we were going all through the North Pole area, because we had soldiers and sailors and all kinds of military stationed all up through that area because of the Cold War and the fear of planes coming over that way. So besides playing all the bases up there, we have a lot of bases up there.
Yeah.
We also would get in our Army planes and Navy planes, and we would fly over, and down below, way down below, you'd see a little teeny iceberg with just a little hut on it, but some of our military would be there, and they're kind of the watch guys, you know, watching for these planes.
Right.
And this was not the day of today's telephone.
Right.
And so what we would do, they would radio from the plane down to these young men who were stationed down below. And believe it or not, just like in the movies, we would play on the planes, and we would play, and I would sing to the guys that were down there, down below, and all these little outposts all over the area. That was fun.
I understand that Pee Wee Hunt, in spite of his name, was a pretty big guy, wasn't he?
Oh, no, he was big. He was tall, and
so
he was
big. So the Pee Wee was kind of a joke, right?
It was a joke, because he was big, and a charming, wonderful man. All the fellas in the band were so great. They really were.
I love 12th Street Rag, and I love the piano player on that record, I believe, was Carl Fisher. And, my gosh, it's just unbelievable. That 12th Street Rag was a huge hit, number one.
Yep. Yep.
Now, were you the girl singer with all three of these bands?
Oh, yeah. And also Johnny Long. Do you remember Shanty and Old Shanty Town?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Yeah, and I worked on that. They did that record again, and I was on that one. I did one album with Johnny Long.
Is that the term that they were using back then, girl singer?
Yeah, girl singer. But, you know, my husband managed Rosemary Clooney for years. He was with her when she did Come Out of My House. We were good friends until the day he died and she died. So it was really a nice relationship. My husband at that time was with Columbia Records, and she was making this record. And Mitch Miller was on this, and someone on guitar named Billy Muir was also on this. A very coincidence. Anyway, she did not want to do it. She did not want to insult the Italian people, number one. Number two, she felt herself more a jazz singer, which if you think about it, she really is. So Mitch Miller called her into the other room, and my husband, too, who is now her manager also. And Mitch Miller said, I'd like to do the tune, Rosemary. She said, oh, I really hate it. I really don't want to do it. He said, but Rosemary, I hired a harpsichord.
Ah.
And she said, I don't care. Then he said to her, I love this song. But Rosemary, I hired a harpsichord player. I don't care. I don't want to do the tune. He said, well, let me put it another way. You do it or you're off the label. I'll do it.
And the harpsichord player was Stan Freeman.
Was that who it was?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Anyway, she did the tune. And, of course, I can remember to this day, the day that I heard it riding in a car, coming home from a job when I was singing in Boston. And that harpsichord and that whole, as Billy says, the hook that was there. And then she came in and did that tune, and it was just great.
Come on to my house, I'm gonna give you candy. Come on to my house, I'm gonna give you apple, plum, and apricot, do I?
She also did other Italian songs like
Bacio
Me.
Yeah, she did Bacio Me. She wasn't too happy about that either.
Yeah. And, of course, the harpsichord was also used on another one of her big hits, namely This Old House. If Mitch Miller told you to do something, he pretty much got his way, didn't he?
Yeah, he really did. He was so good. He was an A&R man, artist and repertoire, and he did his par excellence.
He died shortly before what would have been his 100th birthday last year. I always liked the song, We'll Build a Bungalow. You did this one with the Johnny Long Orchestra.
Right.
And the Long Shots. How old were you when you recorded this?
17.
17?
You know, with the big bands, one thing we had that's kind of fun, some of the big bands had megaphones.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and we had the megaphones, and when we would do this song, or when we would do Shanty and Old Shanty Top, all the fellows would pick up their megaphones and sing through the megaphones, which is just kind of a fun gimmick.
So Rudy Valley was not the only one to use a megaphone.
No, he was not. I worked with him, by the way.
Oh, really?
I worked with him on the same bill with Brenda Lee. How's that for a stretch?
Oh, my gosh.
She was like 12, and he was whatever age he was.
Anyway, we're going to listen to it right now. Debbie Brown, at the age of 17.
Down on the corner, on the soda fountain, out in the meadow, on a weedy road. Everybody singing, even Roomy Dust. So join in the chorus, wait for us.
Oh, we'll build a bungalow, big enough for two. Big enough for two, my honey, big enough for two. And when we're married, happy we'll be.
Great song, and that was Debbie Brown. We could play a Now track. We've got three here. How recent is the Now ones?
Is this the Billy Muir one? Billy on guitar.
Yeah, Billy Muir arrangements and guitar solo. Here's That Rainy Day.
Let me tell you about that. We were recording three other songs, and we had a few minutes left, and Debbie spied a guitar on the wall because I was just conducting this thing. She said, why don't you grab the guitar and let's do a song? I said, okay, what do we do? She said, how about Here's That Rainy Day? And we did it with just guitar.
And one take.
And one take, and I think that's the best song on the whole album.
Well, we got to play it then.
Yeah.
And it was a funky old guitar, too.
All right.
The engineer said, oh, don't play that guitar, Billy. That's terrible. Billy can make any guitar sound wonderful, you know.
Billy is so good, he could probably take a broomstick and make music out of it.
That's it's true.
Feel. Are you Debbie Murphy on this?
Yes, Debbie Murphy.
Debbie Murphy, Here's That Rainy Day. What year are we talking about?
Oh, that was, what, about 6 years ago, Billy?
Yeah.
Maybe I should have kept those leftover dreams. Funny, but here's that rainy day.
Actually, it's a little bit more than that, right?
Well, we're affianced. He is my fiancé. I am his fiancé.
In other words, you are fiancé and fiancé.
That's correct.
Ah.
Affianced.
Have you set a wedding date yet?
Well, we had set it for when he was 95. That was when he was 88. But we put it forward.
To when
he's 100 now.
To when he's 100.
Yes. We're going to have a huge wedding.
I want you to promise me, Billy, when you turn 100, I want to have the first interview with you when you're 100 years old.
You got it.
He's promised me he'll live to be 125.
I said to the doctor the last visit, I said, if you can keep me alive until 125, I'll make you famous.
Is there any secret that you could share for living a long, productive life?
I wish there was a secret. I'd be a millionaire. No, there's no secret.
I can tell you.
Uh-oh.
He eats Mott's applesauce at every meal.
God.
And he swears that the applesauce keeps him going.
Well, who could deny it?
Anyway, Debbie wrote to Mott's. And she said, I have a gentleman here who's 95 years old, and he's eaten Mott's applesauce almost every day of his life. What do you think about that? Tell him what they did, Deb.
They sent me a huge, huge T-shirt that said Mott's on the front.
Oh, gosh.
If that's the secret, then you know it. You know, it's funny.
Yeah.
I tell that to people at where we work, and this friend of mine came by, and he said, you know, I've been eating Mott's applesauce ever since you told me, and I feel different. I feel wonderful.
I have to say one thing, and I'm saying this totally in total honesty.
Right.
Billy,
hello.
You know, can you hear me all right?
There's one thing that Debbie forgot to mention is that she was at the Hotel Pierre, a five-star hotel, one of the best hotels in New York, and she sang with the band there for 10 years.
Oh,
now,
wow.
Now, you can't beat that, right?
Magnificent hotel, and that was fun, because there was a weekly radio show, and a lot was going on in those days. In those days, music was in every corner of New York. It was wonderful.
I have to say, Billy, your voice sounds so young. People are going to think that we're kidding when we say that you're 95 years old. When are you going to celebrate birthday 96?
November 4th. So we've been having big parties since 83, and I've had people at this club where we work every November 4th. There's a big, big party, big cake, and somebody's usually taking a movie of it and everything, so it's really a happening.
That's phenomenal. Well, we got two more orders of business, the song called Toy Balloons.
The biggest song I've ever written is called Toy Balloons, and it was a big hit in England with Russ Conway, who is a giant of an artist in England.
Piano player.
Right.
You did not originally title it Toy Balloons.
No, it was originally called The Balloon Song, and I heard a recording of Sinatra where he says Toy Balloons, and I thought that struck me, and so they suggested changing it to foreign publishers. And that's what I did, change it to Toy Balloons.
When did you write the song?
Oh, my gosh, that should have been 1960.
All right, 19.
By 1961, it was number one in England with Russ Conway.
English lyrics to it, right?
Right.
Okay. And it was a total Billy Muir composition. You didn't have any co-writers. It was just
I wrote that by myself.
going to play a version by the Muir Sisters. And, Billy, who are the Muir Sisters?
The Muir Sisters are my grandchildren, my son's daughters. And that's Lindsay and Emily.
How old were they when they recorded Toy Boy?
I would say around 16 and 18.
I can't thank you enough, Billy. This has been very special in so many ways. You've had a remarkable career, and that is putting it mildly. It's continuing, and you still make an occasional personal appearance, right? Still do.
Two or three times a week. Please.
Two or three times a week. You must be cutting back. You probably used to do it seven times a week. Now it's two
or
three.
Oh, God, yes. And there are weeks when you do that.
Thank you, Billy. And also, thank you, Debbie, for being a part of this interview. And now that everybody heard that you're going to marry this guy at the age of 100, now you're going to have to stick to it because everybody knows that you said this publicly. We're going to close with, believe it or not, you made a video. Actually, you wrote a song called Where Will It End? It became a YouTube video.
When I tried to call BMI and register the letter, they said they got 15, when will it end? So I said, well, I can't change the title because it's all about the government spending too much money. So they suggested call it When Will It End, When Will It End, When Will It End, and that will be different. So that's what we did. We put it together and we hired somebody to put some graphics to it. Have you watched it, by the way?
Yes, I have. And
Originally, I played it naked. Not entirely naked, but I had the banjo in front of me, right?
Yes.
And one of the lines was, government is, what is it?
The government is stripping us naked.
The government is stripping us naked. So we put it out that way with the naked banjo. We thought it was funny. But we got a couple of calls from the Tea Party. They wanted to hear it and see it. And I told them how to find it on YouTube. And I realized that the times are so bad, millions of people out of work, they didn't see any humor in it. So we decided to take it out. So we took that out and took the line out. And it's really terrific. The song, I think, is a really terrific song, which I wrote. And Debbie helped sing on it. But we did several overdubs.
Like four Billy Muirs.
Yeah, four Billy Muirs and four Debbie Murphys.
Well, it's a protest song.
Yes, it's a protest song. We put it in YouTube, and that's where it's at now.
When will it end? When will it end? When will it end?
Bailout, bailout, spend, spend, spend. The country's going broke. When will it end? When will it end? When will it end? The government should hear what protesters have to say, and why our town meetings ignored in every way.
They must change the way they feel. The parties are for real. And when we're on the right track, we'll take our country back. And then maybe if we're lucky, we're gonna get lucky. Right times will appear. You've gotta believe. Bad times will disappear. Good Lord willing. And when the right time comes and we're free, we'll take a big right turn.
Remembers the oldies, the 50s and 60s.